The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I agree that redistribution on a global scale and imagining a kind of world welfare state, although it's been proposed many times, actually, it's not feasible in the next few days or years. But it ought to be the long-term horizon of progressives. But there are other values. We're going to talk about war, but there's also, you know, democracy. And I think we've seen that the value of democracy seems to require us to engage in fair deals in every national setting, if only to stave off disaster. And so it'll be an intricate problem to fit together what to do in every national setting, as long as that's where policy is made with this larger global agenda. But there's no doubt that as a matter of right and wrong, cosmopolitanism is where we need to be heading.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 5th, 2019. Many critics of Donald Trump's foreign policy say the president has undermined the liberal international order. But some progressives question whether liberal internationalism was worthwhile to begin with. On Sunday, Jack Goldsmith had a conversation with Samuel Moyne, a professor of law and history at Yale University who studies that subject. Goldsmith and Moyne talked through how to understand the successes and failures of liberal internationalism, the significance of Donald Trump's effect on it, and what the future holds for the liberal international order. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 389, Progressive Critiques of Liberal Internationalism.
Sam and some other progressive writers have written critiques of liberal internationalism and have proposed alternatives to liberal internationalism as a guide to a progressive foreign policy. Is that fair? Fair summary?
Absolutely. As I say in one of the articles, my attitude towards liberal internationalism and the rules-based order is sort of like Mohandas Gandhi's when asked about Western civilization. He replied, "It sounds like it would be a nice idea." You know, I appreciate liberalism, and I think an internationalism would make a lot of sense. It's just that it's not what we've seen, even in the past couple of decades, let alone since 1945.
Okay, so let's get out on the table for our listeners what the kind of conventional view of what liberal internationalism is. What is this thing? Where did it come from? What are its claims to fame? What are its ostensible virtues?
So I think the dominant story is that at the end of World War I, Woodrow Wilson wanted to make the world safe for democracy. And at that time, the Senate wouldn't let him. But eventually, isolationism was overcome, and America won World War II, founded the United Nations, helped craft the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the rest is history until Donald Trump. I think the truth is...
And just to be clear, that's the conventional wisdom.
That's the conventional wisdom. Right. I mean, there are debates about Wilson's exact role and what to do about the fact that there was a Cold War at some point.
And you mentioned in one of your pieces that the phrase liberal internationalism really didn't get going until the 80s or 90s. Is that right?
I mean, there are a few examples of it earlier, but the big rise in usage of the phrase liberal internationalism occurs in the 80s. And I don't think that's accidental, because two things happen then. First, liberals who have really run the Cold War since its inception decide they've made some mistakes. just
when you say liberals have run the Cold War, you mean liberal presidents.
Yeah, Democrats. Yeah. Democrats in office. Not that Republicans, you know, were against it. Some more were than you might think, but Democratic presidents initiated it and, among other things, escalated the Vietnam War. And so in the 70s, the Democrats rethink their foreign policy, and they want it to be different than the Cold War strategy they had adopted up to that point. But much more important, they also sign on to what we call neoliberalism, which is the promotion, which has marked the last 50 years in both parties, of economic liberty
and which freedom. Is associated market freedom, including both at home, but especially in international affairs. So the global free trade movement is one way of capturing.
That's right. Either in bilateral relations, or even more prominently through the international financial institutions that the United States often controls.
So, and what role does American military power play in this conception of liberal internationalism?
Well, you'd think that after Vietnam, the decision by liberals to change their posture would have lessened militarism. And in one sense, it did. There hasn't been a war of that kind since. But we also know that the liberals are very frightened of what will happen if they stand for peace. They've put up George McGovern to disastrous loss. And so they care about human rights, but they also have this great fear that they will lose elections if they don't back American military supremacy and the use of American arms, at least on occasion. And so they continue to use it. And often it's with this new humanitarian rationale, or at least rhetoric.
And speaking of humanitarian, so what, and this is what you're the world's expert on, what part does the rise of human rights and human rights law and American foreign policy, starting with Jimmy Carter, play in this cluster of ideas that are liberal internationalism?
Well, Jimmy Carter is really the pivotal player in both of the stories, because when he's inaugurated, he mounts the steps of the Capitol and says that as a result of its Vietnam mistakes, the country should stand for the promotion of morality in foreign affairs. He's also the president who takes the biggest step towards moving the United States towards neoliberalism, even before Ronald Reagan's election.
What are the examples of that? I know that there was a deregulation movement domestically.
That's right, and the appointment of Paul Volcker to the Fed.
Right. And for me, the idea of liberal internationalism reached its height in the Clinton administration.
Absolutely.
Which was when NAFTA happened, sure. Kosovo, the glow of the Cold War victory,
exactly.
the end of history. I mean, that really sort of is the high point. Is that fair?
Sure. I mean, when I was young in that decade of the 1990s and worked in the White House as an intern myself, I think everyone thought that human rights, having been discovered in the midst of the Cold War to chasten the way we fought it, would now be the morality of the end of history. And all that remained was to bring American principle to the benighted lands that where genocide still occurred. But, at the same time, the real weight in foreign policy was placed behind, the free market agenda.
Right. So there's also, this is the last piece for me anyway, and I'm wondering what you think about this, there's also a causal claim about this cluster of ideas that liberal internationalism was somehow causally efficacious on producing global wealth, and especially outside the United States, but also that it was good for inequality inside the United States because it would increase wealth, and that there was a claim about liberal internationalism and peace as well. So there were the happy story about liberal internationalism was that it was both wealth creating and peace creating. Was that part of it?
I think that's true. It really seemed as if all the major questions had been settled, and it's absolutely true that the rise of liberal interventionism was seen as in the service of creating a durable peace for the world by rooting out those last despots who were interfering with it. And of course, we now know that through that kind of talk, the road was paved to Iraq and Libya and so many other, you know, mistakes. But you're also completely right to think that neoliberalism was seen as the ultimate win-win. It would make nobody worse off and nobody unhappy. And, you know, I think the verdict of history on that score is clear. You can defend it, but it's not as if it has, you know, no discontents in the mix.
It's hugely divisive, and it's arguably, its failures are arguably the cause of, or at least a contributing cause of, global populism. We'll get to that. Okay, so that is, I think, the standard conception, I think a fair conception of what liberal internationalism is. So what is your essential critique? You've done this in several pieces, but how would you tie it together?
Well, I think, you know, the main critique is that it's brought much less peace than a kind of, you know, endless war footing. And there have been a lot of disasters, but even taking those out, Iraq, Libya, and so forth, it's left us with a militarized globe, not a pacified one. And it's all in the service of, and mainly a rationale, which fooled a lot of people, for this other big project, which is the enrichment of the rich.
No wonder people are upset. Which is the enrichment of the rich, which is the claim about what, in fact, neoliberalism, global free trade, did.
I think that's what drove it, and by that I mean the transnational rich. It's not exactly helped Americans, you know, across their rank and file. It's not that Americans, any of them, are worse off, but certainly the middle has stagnated as the rich have reaped the biggest gains in common with the rich everywhere.
And how about the poor everywhere, though? I mean, if you take a global perspective, if you include China and other, especially Southern Asian countries that were, that have seen extraordinary growth and development, and especially the poorest. You tell me, I mean, what's the story there?
No, I mean, I think you have to have the balance sheet in front of you in order to make a fair assessment. And there's no doubt that, again, largely thanks to China, that hundreds of millions have been saved through Chinese state marketization from so-called extreme poverty, which the World Bank defines as a dollar and change a day. Now, we should also add that if we're interested in global inequality, it's also gotten a bit better in the age of neoliberalism. China, again, has a lot to do with it, but so does
India. And when you say better, there are many ways of defining inequality getting better. What do you have in mind
exactly?
Well,
it's so if you look at the global Gini, which is, you know, the measurement economists use to measure inequality, how much do the rich have relative to the middle and the poor? It can be an incredibly distended curve where the rich benefit, or it can be one where there's moderation and you know, the different classes of people now in a world setting get closer together. And it's pretty clear, based on the work of an economist named Branko Milanovic, that the world is more equal now in very spotty ways. Right. The trouble is that that's come along with policies that have at the same time made most nations more unequal.
Are those the neoliberal policies or the militaristic policies, or both?
The neoliberal ones. I mean, I assume that, you know, global war is a more or less separate topic. We have to ask why the United States is fighting it.
We'll get to that. So, okay, this is a standard critique of neoliberalism, and it became, you know, frankly, it became much more fashionable with the rise of Donald Trump, because he was the one, he was the person who put it on the American political agenda. I think that's, so a couple of questions about that. We had a class together this week. We read a bunch of articles about progressive proposals for fixing this problem. And they seemed a little thin to me on this front. So a couple of questions. What is the baseline? Is the focus for the progressive critique national interest, national welfare, U.S. interest? Is the focus cosmopolitanism? Should we be thinking about this as global welfare? If it's the latter, how do you think about distributional consequences in that context? And what are the concrete alternatives? Is it a kinder, gentler neoliberalism with more right. guaranteed social redistribution like was promised 30 years ago? What is the alternative?
So I'll start by saying there is a debate within the left about how much to lean more nationalist and how much to lean cosmopolitan. My own view is that we shouldn't have deep concern about the stagnating middle and working classes in the developed economies because they're still some of the best off people in the world. And yet they're also the ones who seem to be voting for the populace. And so they need some love. That's not to say we should, you know, take our policies in a nationalist direction and continue privileging them as has long been done over the rest of humanity. The real question,
Listeners are clear, you're making the point, correct me if I'm wrong, that the basically what we think of as the forgotten people who turned out to be Trump supporters, who have been the losers in globalization over the last 30 years. Your point is that they're a very important constituency to be addressed, but that in the general scheme globally, these are not the worst off and they shouldn't be the primary focus. Is that right?
They should be the primary focus insofar as they're important voters and they have a legitimate complaint in a world where it may be true that some of the global poor are getting out of poverty, but the main effect is that the rich are winning. And it's totally fair for them to wonder whether they shouldn't get, you know, a greater share of the national income or the global income, or whether it's really the price of global justice that the rich come out unfailingly on top. So I don't think it is. Right. I think we can imagine an alternative in which we engage in some old-fashioned redistribution, both from the global north to the global south and from the rich to the wretch. It's in every society. You know, it was the case that liberals believed in strong government that redistributed. And in a way, you know, it's scandalous to even think it, but FDR is really the great progenitor of Donald Trump in American politics as the, you know, the politician of the white male working class. And so if we idolize FDR, we have to, you know, take a second look at Trump because he's speaking for some people who at a minimum need some love for strategic reasons.
But let me emphasize that for strategic reasons, because if I understand you correctly, you're saying that in your view, the progressive foreign policy should be oriented towards have a cosmopolitan orientation, and that the ones that have been left out of the United States, the core of the Trump voters, they need to be addressed primarily because so we can deal with these larger questions.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, we should hold out for the win-win where we can achieve growth. Remember, the greatest growth in many of these industrialized economies was at the time of an interventionist welfare state, and we should hope that we can hold out for growth and for fair distribution, which would involve moderating the wealth gap in the world and in various, you know, societies like the American one.
So I can imagine all of that. What I can't imagine, you talked about redistribution, and that's hard in any society. It's hard enough to do in American society. Right. Has it ever happened on a global basis, really? And isn't the most you can hope for is redistribution?
It's happened from the poor to the rich many times.
Yeah, exactly. You're talking about a redistribution globally,
right,
across countries from rich nations to poor nations. I just think about the climate change context. That's been what's holding everything up for decades now, is that the rich countries, despite all the talk, have not been willing to absorb more of the costs. And that's true in so many other areas, and it's not hard to understand. Even our foreign aid is clearly designed to serve national interests. There's not a lot of redistribution that's ever gone on from rich countries to poor countries. So why isn't the most we can hope for is to fix the problem at home and not globally? So my question is, why isn't the national orientation the right one?
So, you know, I agree that redistribution on a global scale and imagining a kind of world welfare state, although it's been proposed many times, actually, it's not feasible in the next few days or years, but it ought to be the long-term horizon of progressives. But there are other values. We're going to talk about war, but there's also, you know, democracy. And I think we've seen that that seems to, the value of democracy seems to require us to engage in fair deals in every national setting, if only to stave off disaster. And so it'll be an intricate problem to fit together what to do in every national setting, as long as that's where policy is made with this larger global agenda. But there's no doubt that as a matter of right and wrong, cosmopolitanism is where we need to be heading.
Okay, I'm not sure I agree with you on that one, but I'm not going to challenge you on that here. Maybe I will, just to this extent.
All right.
I mean, why isn't the best example, in fact, of redistribution of wealth from rich to poor countries in the aggregate neoliberalism?
So far, it is.
So can you explain that and tell me why that isn't?
Question is whether we can do even better without, as neoliberalism has done, you know, stagnating the ordinary common man and woman in these advanced economies. And if we think kind of historically, we conclude that it wasn't through free markets that, you know, fair distribution was achieved in these very societies. And there's no reason not then to infer that at the global scale, the same will be the case. That's a long-term proposition.
Okay, but maybe so. The reason I'm skeptical is because I think, yeah, it's a very long-term proposition, because you have to imagine some more robust form of global government for that to happen. Mm-hmm. I think in one of your pieces yourself, you said no one has really fleshed that out yet.
Yeah.
And the successful examples of the type of redistribution you're talking about take place in an environment where you can actually engage in coercive government action. That's what
I think. That's
you
true.
You have to have a politics that supports it, and you have to have the ability to have coercive action.
But Jack, right, remember, now, we already have global governance, and it's neoliberal. Fair. So it's not as if we don't have a global stage in which there's been policy making and in which neoliberals have successfully executed an end run around national sovereignty already.
So that's a fair point. That's a very fair point. My point is just that it's hard to make that mechanism work to help the poor.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me that the mechanisms that can be made to help work the poor, in theory, at least as we can imagine it now, are ones that take place within the nation state, within governments. Because what neoliberalism lacks is a mechanism for coercion,
yes,
against the wealthy in favor of the poor.
Right.
It just doesn't have that. And you can imagine
that
it can happen
in
the domestic realm.
That
seems to me to be the great puzzle at the global level.
It is a huge puzzle. And I'll just note that before neoliberalism, it's the puzzle that kind of obsessed a lot of thinkers when they observe that the very mechanism used to build welfare, namely the nation state, is the one that would have to be overcome to raise welfare to the global stage. And of course, they failed in their time.
It's possible. I mean, I think it's impossible to achieve what you say may happen over the long term, but that's a strong claim.
In the end, it's just scale. I mean, it would be like saying, you know, welfare is only possible in Missouri or Arkansas, but not at the federal level, when in fact the reverse was true.
I agree. Well, I would say it's scale, but it's not just scale. Because mm-hmm. at some point, I mean, this is a standard set of claims about why global government isn't possible. At some point, you just can't. It takes a level of homogeneity and shared values and mm-hmm. shared culture mm-hmm. at some level mm-hmm. to make a nation state work, and that it's practically impossible to do that on the global level. You've heard these arguments before. What do you think of that basic? I think Kant made that point, frankly.
He was actually more concerned about so-called universal monarchy, and he felt that if there were just one zone of governance, it would be controlled by some despot.
But didn't he think that universal democracy was a practical impossibility?
He really just opposed a kind of world state just on the grounds it was likely to be a universal monarchy.
So I won't
monarchy.
Associate that idea with Kant, but it's a,
he
it's
didn't,
a standard idea.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was a standard idea that, you know, it was going to be a mistake to strive for federal power and empowerment of the central government over those of the states in American history, and it happened.
So I want to move on to militarism, unless you want to say anything else about this. Nope. Is that okay? So I'm sympathetic to the critique of neoliberalism, although, as you can tell, I don't necessarily agree with the prescriptions. But I'm more sympathetic, for what it's worth, to the critique of militarism. And why don't you just flesh it out?
So in spite of talking a lot about human rights since the 70s, America has been a warfare state. It became one really in these pivotal, you know, months and years after December 7th, 1941. And it in the age of liberal internationalism since the 1980s, it really has not changed its posture. We've seen a lot of high-minded rationalizations, but in fact, we live in an age of perpetual American war. And I don't think we should think of them as accidents any longer, or one-offs that just, you know, sadly transpire every few years.
So what is the, so they're not accidents that transpire. What is the causal mechanism? So let me separate a couple of things.
All right.
Let's just get a couple of different types of wars, perpetual wars that we're in.
All right.
So we've been in a form of perpetual war against certain forms of transnational terrorists since 9/11. Sure. So there's that. Then there are so-called humanitarian interventions of the type that you might see. Libya is a great example. Kosovo, there's that. Then there's Iraq, which it's hard to categorize. It was justified partly on humanitarian grounds, partly on terrorist grounds, partly on democratization grounds.
Right.
But there was that. And so I would say, I'm just wondering what you think of this way of slicing it up. Iraq, failure on its own terms, self-defeating in a massive way. Humanitarian intervention usually doesn't work out very well. There may be an exception in Kosovo, although that's a contested case.
But well, not work out very well is an understatement when it comes to a place like Libya.
Yeah, I was about to say, but Libya is a clear disaster.
Right.
And even Barack Obama has said more than once it was right. The biggest mistake of his presidency. So those are at least three different types of perpetual war. Maybe not perpetual war. The perpetual war really is the 9/11 stuff.
Yeah.
But do you see this as all of a piece of militarism that we're kind of addicted to? What's the causal mechanism?
So, I mean, that's a really tough question because it's hard to answer. I would say, you know, it's fair to disaggregate, but you can also aggregate and think, as, say, Andrew Bacevich does, of this 50-year America's Great War in the Middle East. And it does seem highly localized there, although now it's begun, mm-hmm. thanks to drone warfare, to bleed out, you know, elsewhere, especially tracking the borders of Islam, but deep into Africa. And there's a global basing system, which in theory opens up a lot of future possibilities. So I think, you know, one clear reason is that you are building the biggest army known to history, and America's been doing that and devoting a large proportion of its budget to that project for decades. And it's hard to imagine it remaining unused.
And it's worse than that because, as you point out, this is not discussed enough in mainstream conversations, in my opinion. The United States is also sponsoring this gigantic global arms trade.
Right. That's right. So there's, you know, the Cold War involved lots of direct intervention. Those were put on hold in between Vietnam and 9/11. But there was always indirect intervention, notably proxy war. But then, beyond those, you know, kinds of interventions, there has been the global arms trade, which America leads by leaps and bounds. And so it's hard to understand how the liberal internationalist promoters of something like America's recent role in the world can support this level of militarization. Nowadays, you know, since Barack Obama's presidency, it's taken a somewhat different form away from the heavy footprint post 9/11 interventions in favor of light or no footprint ones. But it's staggering that Trump has continued that development, whether in the form of massive drone use or escalation of the use of special forces in three quarters of the country and countries in this, on the surface of the earth in his first year.
Right. Okay. I want to separate some of these things out, and then we'll talk to how Trump has continued them. So let's just focus on humanitarian intervention. Let's talk about Kosovo may be the response by Trump to the chemical weapons attack in Syria and especially Libya. The puzzle for me is, for a whole bunch of reasons, I think that humanitarian intervention is, in general and in most cases, a bad idea. The puzzle for me is that it seems to have not gone well. It didn't go well if that's what Iraq was. That was an utter disaster. Libya, an utter disaster. Whatever we've been doing in Syria, it's hard to say whether it's helped or hurt, but it hasn't been successful. Kosovo strikes me as a problematic case, maybe a success, but it's not obvious. The amazing thing to me is that the foreign policy elite that tends to support humanitarian intervention in both parties, there doesn't seem to be any learning that comes from the failure, the costs of intervention, the costs of the aftermath, the after party, and the like. So what are we to make of this? Is this part of the militaristic mindset?
I think it gives occasions for using the hardware for some, but then for the morally sensitive, in the absence of any better remedies to creating, durable, prosperous societies abroad, it becomes tempting to turn to a quick fix. And maybe, and there's a very rare circumstance, take the Yazidis just as one, plausibly successful example. It might make sense. You have a sufficiently isolated population. You can save from, horrendous, brutality and, without kind of any long-term governance.
That's more of a defensive.
That's right.
Now, you're not overthrowing a government.
And again, pushing Muammar Gaddafi back from the gates of Benghazi could have, and in my view, should have taken that same form. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's too often the case that liberal internationalists either desire or get caught up in regime change that they might themselves disavow. But the bigger issue is that no one has a recipe for misrule in these societies as if it could just be magically replaced. Yeah. And so I think with respect to humanitarian intervention, if you just adopt the mantra of the, medical doctors, first do no harm, you'd be a lot better off, maybe reserving it as a tool for incredibly rare situations. Now, that doesn't deal with the kind of global hierarchies involved where you talk about humanity, but in fact, you're authorizing one country to use its heavy weaponry. No one would propose, I assume, a humanitarian intervention in the aftermath of Mike Brown slaying or, in support of Black Lives Matter. And that just goes to show that maybe American problems aren't as bad, but maybe a humanitarian intervention seems to be a recipe for, the exercise of power from the top of a hierarchy.
Indeed, from the top of a hierarchy in the West, because the United States opposes humanitarian intervention when it's being done by the Russians or states in the Middle East or the Chinese.
Of course.
And we've been playing this dance for at least 20 years about trying to square this with international law. It's clearly a violation of international law, humanitarian intervention. There's been a movement to try to rationalize that it's consistent with international law, but then the reason our State Department has hesitated to do that is precisely because we don't want to legitimize other nations doing it. Now, I don't think, as you know, I don't think that international law is consequential here one way or the other, but it's really stranded. The strange thing is that a lot of the proponents of humanitarian intervention are also international law compliance types.
That's right. It's a puzzle. But, I think at the end of the day, you observe that we're very good at believing that other people's humanitarian interventions are pretextual, but our own, never.
Right. That's a good way of putting it. Okay, let's move on to the harder case for critiquing American militarism, and that is the terrorist threat. Mm-hmm. So you've been the most incisive critic of clean war. Why don't you basically say, I don't want to put words.
Sure.
So, say what your criticism is.
So I think that, really after Vietnam, which was, among other things, a public relations disaster for American hegemony and especially for the American military, there was a decision to legalize and self-legalize. And it's quite extraordinary the extent to which the American military has been willing to take applicable law seriously. especially when it governs the conduct of hostilities.
So jus in bello rules.
Jus in bello rules. Right.
Because we were just talking, just to be clear, we were just talking about how the United States is not terribly attentive to jus ad bellum, United UN Charter rules, rules limiting the use of force in other nations.
That's right.
You're talking about taking very seriously the rules that govern the conduct of war.
Correct. So we've seen an erosion of attention to and obedience of rules governing, you know, the resort to force, the initiation and continuation of hostilities, both as a matter of international law, but also, and even more important, as a matter of domestic law, whether it comes to, you know, constitutional arrangements or statutes like the War Powers Resolution. Meantime, those wars have become, let's call them, more humanely fought. Now, of course, there is a group of humanitarians that will always rightly insist that, you know, there aren't just bad apples and honest mistakes, but militaries will always have a reason to push the envelope and could fight wars that are even more humane. So you've had, you know, accusations that the Pentagon undercounts drone victim deaths, civilian collateral damage. And I assume that humanitarians are right, but what's often missed is that there's substantial agreement now between the military and humanitarians that there will be no critique of war making, and there's going to be agreement around making the wars that happen compliant with the rules governing
and
hostilities.
Just the punchline is that the consequence is it basically makes war easy to go to,
that's
easier
right.
to conduct forever.
That's right. So a humane war is one that could be harder to end. And so, you know, my own, you know, complaint is not that, you know, war, we shouldn't, you know, demand more humane war, but that we should attend to the risk that it could entrench the very thing we're trying to contain.
Namely being war. And the other piece of that for me, and I think you agree with this, is this humane war has also become stealth war. And stealth war conducted by a voluntary military.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is kind of being conducted off the democratic book, so to speak. It's
That's
not
right.
part of.
That's right.
Which also makes it harder to stop.
That's right.
Is that fair?
It is. I mean, so the funding is on the democratic books because all the legislators are voting for it. I mean, that would presumably. I mean, you know, it's as if it's their responsibility to build the army. And to disclaim responsibility when it's used, and they are able to, you know, turn the trick because the wars are invisible, and to the extent they're not invisible, they're humane.
And let me also say that just to underscore that point, we often hear, I've said this before, although I've started speaking differently now, that the war against the Islamic State is a unilateral presidential war. Obama decided on his own to interpret the AUMF to extend it to the Islamic State.
Right.
There's been calls to get Congress on board. We need to have a debate about this. The fact of the matter is that there's huge bipartisan support in Congress through funding specifically designed to fight ISIS, including in Syria. No one is fooled about what's going on. This is not just a presidential decision.
Yeah.
It is something that, and it's bipartisan support in Congress.
Absolutely.
And yet, it's not discussed. It's not.
Right.
So it makes it, and there, you know, because it's war at a distance, there aren't American casualties.
Right.
The whole thing, I think, is designed. You could say this is insidious, or you could say that it's not, but the whole thing is designed to make it not controversial at home, not on the front pages at home.
That's right. So it's been a brilliant success for those who like the outcomes. And, you know, I do think that we're in a situation where a minority initially will have to object. And I think it will come from, you know, strange places because there's an old right-wing critique of American empire and overextension. And there's a left-wing critique of American militarism and empire. And I think that neither group is enough on its own to try to raise the cost for the legislature, first of all, of behaving in the way you've described, which is to authorize wars through funding
on the greatest military ever seen
and not pay the price.
So let me ask you, but the hard question for you, and it's the question I don't know the answer to is, and this is where I think that the humanitarian intervention critique is easier than the critique of the forever war, is that there's a real threat there. that and that the threat from transnational terrorism is real, that our strategy might not be great, this kind of whack-a-mole stealth strategy of war from a distance or war on the ground with small groups, but that the threat is real and that this is the least expensive, most humane way to keep it at bay.
Sure.
Now, I suspect you disagree with that, but I don't know how either one of us can
assess it. Well, you know, it requires a counterfactual that, on my part, which is hard to prove, but... You know, what I object to in the idea that there's just terrorism as a kind of grass that's growing and we just have to cut it every so often is that it's, you know, terrorism is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. It's a political act and it's one that we've invited. Now, that's not to say that there aren't evil human beings who need to be, you know, interdicted and policed, but it is to say that we've spent decades now creating the problems we're now claiming to solve and creating them again and again. So I think that there's a good enough reason at a minimum to consider, you know, taking these threats and treating them, you know, more realistically. One of the few things I'll say in defense of Barack Obama is that on very rare occasions, he acknowledged the importance of the peace perspective, like in the moment he was denounced by Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, and especially when he acknowledged, and it happened with some regularity, that politicians have to tell the populace that the threat of terrorism is not as bad as they think and respond accordingly.
But let me ask you about that. So you have, and I think Obama came in wanting to do that deeply. Deeply ideologically committed to it, I would say. And he was elected on that platform.
That's right.
Although there was a little ambiguity about what he was going to do with terrorism.
Of course, really, that's true.
He made a bigger deal out of reducing the footprint.
Course.
But still, this was a man who came in with serious concerns about American overreach. And one way to interpret his presidency is he just couldn't pull it off. Now, there
are
maybe two accounts for that. One is the blob, the Washington establishment, the military establishment. Yeah. Gave him, just made it impossible for even the president of the United States to do anything different. And the other interpretation is he got an office, he had the responsibility of the office, he saw the threats, and he thought that this was the right way to go.
Sure.
Now, he's acknowledged Libya as an overstep, but so what do you make of that cluster of things?
So I think it's a great point, and it I think what it most strongly suggests is that at present, you know, anti-war presidents will be overcome by the deep state. It's happened twice now. And yet I don't think we can hold Obama in particular blameless. It's wonderful that he acknowledged, you know, the Libyan mistake, but he hasn't confessed his sins with respect to the broader posture. And above all, with creating this move from the heavy footprint to the lighter no footprint, which, you know, Trump gives all signs of actually taking to its logical conclusions.
So I want to move to Trump. Just one more thing on Obama. But isn't it possible, I mean, isn't the Obama presidency possible evidence that if this most peace-sensitive of all presidents comes in and sees the lay of the land, and even he thinks that we have to be militaristic, and although he tries to do it in a less controversial way, at least at home, I mean, maybe that's just evidence that there's a real threat there. What do you say to that?
It's possible. And, you know, I don't have the intel, and so it's possible. I think he also acknowledged that he was forced to exaggerate the threat for electoral reasons, but above all that he made, you know, choices of what, you know, where to fight. And in this domain, I think he proved too compliant. And that was a choice he made, and it's one that a different president could make differently.
It'll be interesting to see what he says about these issues in his memoir, because I know he's been reflecting on this. So let's finally get to Trump. Trump also ran as an anti-war president, and in many ways he has taken more aggressive steps than Obama to follow through on those promises. He ramped up the drone wars with regard to ISIS and arguably achieved some moderate success there. But at the same time, he kind of, to everyone's surprise, ordered troop withdrawals or drawdowns in Syria and Afghanistan. And he's, you know, like everything with Trump, He also is engaged in two interventions in Syria. It's not clear there's a coherent
error
there. That's
right.
But he does seem to have these tendencies. He ran on them. And in a way, he's been more effective, at least partially, in pushing back on the military.
That's right. So he has been willing, I think, surprisingly, to face the blob. And that's, you know, for all of his sins, something, you know, worth emphasizing. I think we should begin with, you know, by reminding ourselves that neither one is a pacifist.
Neither Trump nor Obama.
Yeah,
right?
Both Obama and Trump ran against so-called stupid wars. But I think, you know, Trump is someone who sensed the exhaustion of the country with endless war. And I think that the trouble is that his answer to that syndrome, you know, which requires courage to stand up at the generals, is really to shift more radically, not towards peace, but towards where Obama wanted to go.
I mean, more of stealth war.
So we have a bigger defense budget than under any president under Trump. And we have a greater reliance on drones and especially special forces.
Right. And yet, while I agree that Trump is certainly no pacifist, it is remarkable that he was very aggressively critical of the Iraq intervention, very aggressively critical of traditional 25-year Republican approach to foreign policy. And he won on that issue within the Republican Party, and he beat Hillary Clinton on it. And and that's two presidents in a row, as you pointed out, who have run really on not a pacifist platform by any stretch, but on an a form of an anti-war platform.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, it's very remarkable, and it suggests that there's, to me, mainly, that there's an opportunity for more to come, because it doesn't seem that Americans are going to return to their Cold War, post-Cold War posture, where they understand and accept and even, you know, demand a militarization of the globe. There's no need for it in their eyes, and they've solicited leaders who have tried to take a different path. Now, Trump is not the right one. As we know, in other domains, he's put neoconservatives in power, like John Bolton and Elliot Abrams very recently. And, you know,
all the other ones have gone to the Democrat Party. That's right.
We don't know what, you know, Trump's end game is in Venezuela. Some people think that he's interested in pulling out of the Middle East only in order to maintain a kind of, you know, traditional hemispheric security zone. So I don't think there's much to write home about, except for the fact that he's broken the mainstream assumptions about the boundaries of debate.
Let's talk about that, because I think there are many surface similarities or commonalities between what I would call the progressive foreign policy agenda that we started out talking about and Trump. So, for example, anti-militarism, fundamental critique of neoliberalism, fundamental critique of foreign policy elites. These are things that Trump also proposed, and I think is common, at least more or less common in the progressive side. And also, as you and I were discussing earlier today, that this type of discussion wouldn't even be possible without Trump. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Sure. So, there are silver linings, and I think Trump's presidency reveals to us a lot about the default assumptions that have been held in common amongst American elites about how you run a country, about what the boundaries of policy are, and I think that's just an educational moment for all of us to understand how much, you know, the parties have shared and what elite governance has been about. And it's in part because he's beyond the pale that you've seen the liberal freakout and the never Trump phenomenon on the right, which have been some of the most remarkable, I think, ideological developments of our time. Now, that doesn't mean you are glad that Trump was elected or that you welcome what he pretends, but it does mean that you conclude that the default assumptions with which we've been living for so long are not eternal, and you look for, you know, the right politician to capitalize on the discontent with endless war and with, you know, economic neoliberalism.
Okay, I just have two more. I have two more questions on that last point, just to drive it home. So I've seen a lot more of what I would call very progressive proposals in foreign policy in elite publications like Foreign Affairs, right, post-Trump,
of course,
and in general circulation. I mean, Steve Walt's book got maybe more traction than it would have gotten in a Clinton presidency. So in some sense, I mean, I think this is your point, not mine, but I just want you to comment on it. In some sense, and I guess this is what you were saying, Trump has, in a strange way, even though he's the worst standard bearer for some of these ideas, he's made possible this opening up of the conversation.
Absolutely. That's why, you know, our task is not to restore normalcy, as so many have insisted, but to reinvent normalcy. And, you know, he's allowed us to see that there's discontent under the existing defaults, whether in, you know, economic matters or foreign policy matters. And I think that we're in a time of great experimentation.
And in that regard, the last point I want to ask you about is you've tantalizingly written about the possibility of a right-left convergence on some of these issues. Can you just sketch that out briefly?
So just in the short term, I think on both of these, you know, fundamental difficulties in, you know, American and global life on the economic front and on the military front, there are groups in on the right and the left who have been marginal for decades. And they can begin to think about their, you know, building their own new coalitions and trying to convince more of the mainstream of their propositions. They failed because they've been really blackballed within their own groups.
Right.
And I think the moment is one in which they're less marginal and therefore they can begin to see, you know, potential alliances. Now in I think the medium or long term, what we're looking for is something like a partisan realignment. You know, these existing discussions presuppose a left and a right that are basically similar to the ones we've known, and as we've discussed, they overlap.
Right.
But there have been losers, you know, from these mainstream assumptions. And they, I think, have the power to change, you know, what the terms of American electoral politics are about. And it's happened before several times. And so I think the ultimate prize is to look into those possible alliances to figure out what exactly we do share and where we disagree. You know, we may have very different reasons to oppose American hegemony and endless war. We may have very different reasons to oppose economic liberalism and its costs, but we can't know until we have the discussion.
That's great. It's a great place to end. Thank you, Sam.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please give the podcast a rating and review wherever you listen to us and share us with your friends and followers on Facebook and Twitter. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.